This would be starting July 2003, since the bill would have sunsetted if this bill is not worked out. This exemption is evaluated in the tax expenditure reports. In your packet, I've included the tax expenditure report page on this issue. It showed an evaluation and a description of that program and how it actually works and impacts the and amounts of money that is estimated for the 03-05 as $3.2 million. We also estimate that there is an additional, of course, for the biennium after that. I include the revenue impact statement in your packets, and there is also a slight fiscal impact statement also in that pack. One thing about the program is the declaration of that program has to be within certain limitations, and those limitations, one of them is that the city cannot declare more than 20% of its score to be in that program. And we do have two amendments. Those amendments are the dash 2 and the dash 3 amendments.
And who's bringing the dash 2s?
The dash 2s, and I believe, was the center of law. Was it? I received them just an hour and a half ago.
Tim Nebel with the Oregon Law Center.
Oregon Law Center. And the dash 3 comes from Bowley. And they are coming to us from Senator Carter's office, too. I haven't had enough time at this point to look at how some of these fees that are proposed in the dash fees, I believe, that will have impacts one way or the other on revenues. But I suspect after reading the dash 2s and dash 3s, there is no mere contradiction and no intersection in a way that they probably could be worked together into the bill if that becomes the direction of the committee.
Thank you. Representative Kafori, and if you want to bring a guest, John Christensen from Senator Margaret Carter's office.
Correct. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Kafori, State Representative, House District 43. I'm going to be very brief because I haven't eaten since 9 o'clock this morning, and I'm going to pass out if I don't soon, so I will.
You want some crackers or something?
No, that's right.
You know, you're with child.
Yeah, I know. It's not just my life I have to worry about anymore. But anyway, I am here to speak in support of both House Bill 2379 and House Bill 2380. Both bills passed unanimously out of the House. House Bill 2379 is especially important to the City of Portland and to my constituents for its impact on low-income housing, which is desperately needed by our citizens. I also wanted to register my support for the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's quick.
Please testify more often.
And John, you just had a good example.
Right. Thank you, Senator. I've concluded my testimony.
Great.
No, for the record, my name is John Christensen. I'm staff, a staff person in the office of State Senator Margaret Carter. We share the same legislative district on the Senate side as Representative Kafori. This is a critical bill to low-income housing. The amendments we've worked with Commissioner Gardner on 3 and also with the Law Center on 2. I've talked to Mr. Malik. He indicated that they could probably be meshed together.
So you're comfortable, both of you
yes,
are comfortable with
yes.
The dash 2s and the dash 3s.
Exactly. And that's it. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Questions?
Thank you.
Enjoy your lunch.
Thanks.
Mike Saba. Marge. And
good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Marge Kafori, representing the City of Portland. And as you've heard, this bill passed unanimously in the House. It was carried by Representative Williams, and it passed with a vote of 56 aye votes, 4 absent. It is a bill that is supported by the builders, by the realtors, by low-income housing advocates, and we know of no opposition to our bill. What this bill does is to renew and amend a statute which is sunsetting. It permits, but it does not mandate, that local governments offer a 10-year property tax abatement for purchases of modestly priced owner-occupied housing. And as you've also heard, there are two amendments, the Dash 2s brought to you by the Oregon Law Center and the Dash 3s, which are brought to you by Boley. We consider them to be friendly amendments, and we have no objection to them. And now, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to introduce to you Mike Saba, who is a senior planner with the City of Portland Bureau of Planning, who will further explain the bill and answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. I'll make this very brief. Again, Mike Saba, City of Portland Planning Bureau, Senator Deckard, members of the committee, thank you for hearing us out today. As was stressed before, this is an important bill for the City of Portland. It's really one of our fuel tools that we can provide first-time home buyers an opportunity to buy modestly priced housing within areas of the city we are designated as distressed areas. It's something we look at every 3 years. Actually, locally, we've redefined those areas not as distressed areas anymore, but for the purposes of the local program, we call them home buyer opportunity areas. And we also impose an income limit on the buyers of this housing, newly constructed infill housing in our areas, our older neighborhoods, inner northeast Portland, north Portland, outer southeast Portland. And we also require that the people who buy these houses now live in the houses. So the original purpose of the bill back in the 89 legislative session when the city originally adopted this in 1992 was to produce housing. Just because some of the areas of the City of Portland had not seen any new housing development except low-income rental housing for decades, 30 years in some cases. This bill has been spectacularly successful in the last 10 years in producing over 1,800 single-family housing units in the inner-city neighborhoods of Portland and providing affordable home buyer opportunities for people of modest incomes. Again, the bill continues this program. As of now, we can't accept new applications. We're working on a backlog of 326 applications, people who submitted the applications prior to the January 1st sunset date. Until this bill is enacted and effective, we can't continue this program anymore. So we're hoping for your support in allowing us to play a fairly minor role in home buying assistance. As you know, most of our public money goes to low-income rental housing, simply because that's determined to be the greatest need. But this is a key element in producing first-time home buyers, people buying their first modest home in the city.
Thank you.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Nothing.
I might add there is an expansion in this bill for the program from the single-family houses to multi-family units, and that adds, in a way, for the program, in addition to the $3.2 million that I've mentioned before. I just needed this to...
I'll get this on the record. Thank you. And Oregonians in Action is no longer interested in amending this bill, correct?
Mr. Chairman, I met with a representative from Oregonians in Action this morning, and they believe that they have another vehicle to pursue their amendment.
Thank you. Thank you. Jeannie Arana.
Good afternoon, Chair Deckard and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jean Arana, and I'm the Community Resources Division Administrator at Oregon Housing and Community Services. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to speak in support of House Bill 2379A to include Boley's proposed amendments, the Dash 3 amendments. The bill as amended with the Dash 3s would address two areas of interest to the department. It would first extend the tax exemption for housing in urban distressed areas by 10 years. And the Dash 3 amendments support fair housing practices and sets up penalties for discrimination. Oregon Housing and Community Service fully supports both aspects of the bill. And in the interest of brevity, the next two paragraphs of my written testimony basically say what the City of Portland says in support of the tax exemption. The Dash 3 amendments would improve the state's fair housing policy in the following way. Current fair housing structure in Oregon is a very weak three-legged stool. Oregon Housing and Community Services carries the banner for setting fair housing policy, education, and outreach. We have a quarter-time FTE devoted to managing the fair housing program. Our responsibility under the consolidated plan is to write and guide activities in the statewide fair housing plan and conduct a periodic statewide analysis of impediments to fair housing. And it's interesting that one of the impediments that was identified when the analysis was done was related to first-time home buyers. So it actually fits even better with the initial part of this bill. Fair Housing Council of Oregon is the second leg and has traditionally been our strategic partner in carrying out the education and outreach portion. They also shoulder the burden of fair housing complaint intake and testing. The third leg, which is enforcement, is currently very inadequate in the state. Fair Housing Council of Oregon has completed over 4,000 intakes since 1991, and presently U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development is the main recipient for those complaints rather than going through BOLI. BOLI, at the same time, reported 59 complaints of housing discrimination during the three fiscal years ending in 1999. Both HUD and BOLI have indicated that resource limitations prevent them from adequately and expeditiously processing the complaints. Oregon's Fair Housing Plan, which is written by our department, is written to require OHCS, Oregon Economic and Community Development, Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Fair Housing Council to form a collaborative to shape policy and a coordinated pursuit of program funding. The landlord and tenant groups would also be represented as a part of this collaborative. BOLI's Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2379A are intended to address the substantial equivalency issue. Assuming bill passage, BOLI wants to pursue federal housing assistance program funds to stabilize and increase the dollars available for fair housing enforcement in Oregon. Current members of the collaborative are very supportive of this strategy. Passage of HB 2379 with BOLI's amendments would provide more units of affordable housing for Oregonians and strengthen fair housing practices throughout the state. Please help us continue to provide housing and assistance to those that need it most. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I would be happy to answer any questions. With me is John Fletcher, who is our policy analyst from the department.
Thank you. Before you go, John, I'm going to tap out of this bill, and we're going to move another bill. We're losing one of our members, and we need to move one bill. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2379, open a work session on SB 747. Senator Farrelly.
Mr. Chairman, I move SB 747 to the Committee for Ways and Means. With a due pass recommendation.
Senator Farrelly has moved Senate Bill 747 to our Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Tara, please call the roll.
Mayor Corcoran?
Aye.
Anna?
Aye.
Greenbill?
No.
Aye.
Farrelly?
Aye.
Ecker?
No. Motion carries. Senate Bill 747 is on its way to Ways and Means. Close that work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you to have one more bill out of our hands and on its way.
All right.
Are you done, Ms. Arana? And Mr. Fletcher, so I'm going to reopen a public hearing on House Bill 2379.
Did you say reopen a work session?
Fletcher, you don't need to testify, so I'll bring up our Labor Commissioner.
From somewhere in the distant past, Senator.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And in the interest of time, I can simply, a lot of it is in my written testimony. And as you heard earlier, the Dash 3 amendments are from the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
you go back in history a little bit, back in 81, 82, Bully did perform federal fair housing investigation and a contract through HUD. However, the federal laws had changed, and we did not keep up with being substantially equivalent with the federal law. Therefore, we, you know, discontinued doing those types of investigations. We're very interested in doing HUD investigations again. And what the Dash 3 amendments simply do is keep us substantially equivalent to the federal law on federal fair housing. And in order for us to look at entering into a contract with the federal government to do so, we would have to have this amendment, and that's the intended purpose of the Dash 3 amendments.
Thank you. Questions for Commissioner Gardner? And you've spoken to the members of the committee or some of them about...
Some of them, Mr. Chair. Actually, there is a wide array of support for this from state housing, from Mr. Repine's office, from the city of Portland. Actually, I'm aware of absolutely no opposition to this Dash 3 amendments whatsoever.
Okay. And the sponsors, they knew about?
The sponsors certainly know about it, both Senator Carter's office and Representative Pofora's office, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. And Mr. Niebel, you have Dash 2s for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center. I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 2379 and specifically the Dash A2 amendments. These amendments, just so you know, are unrelated to the substance of the bill as it's printed, and they also, although they're fair housing amendments, they don't really dovetail with Commissioner Gardner's amendments either. These arise from discussions of a group of landlords and tenants, advocates, who met over the course of probably the better part of a half year to try to work out amendments to the Oregon Residential Landlord-Tenant Act. Included in this group were housing authorities, the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, three landlord groups representing private landlords, several tenant groups, and some fair housing advocates. This specific amendment arose from discussions about how to protect domestic violence victims from arbitrary action by landlords and from discrimination by landlords. And in the course of these discussions, they involved a case that some of you may know about in which a tenant in Clatsop County was threatened with eviction because she had been a domestic violence victim, and the apartment complex in which she lived had a quote-unquote no-tolerance policy for violence. So she got beaten in her dwelling unit, and because she got beaten, she was threatened with eviction. And what the court, or what basically was decided in that case was that this policy, although it was a neutral policy on its face, it applies to all people who live in the housing, in that housing. It has a disparate impact on women who are a protected class under fair housing because they are more generally domestic violence victims than men are. So it was a form of gender discrimination. So in discussing how we could put this into the law, we negotiated basically a definition of this theory, which for lack of a better term is called the disparate adverse impact theory. And that's what the Dash 2 amendments are. It's the reason that I'm here asking you to do this in this bill is that this amendment doesn't fit in our landlord-tenant bill, which is House Bill 2765. It doesn't fit because of a relating clause problem. This is a broader relating clause, and that's where we're asking you folks to consider this amendment. I think that it's fair to say that there's general agreement among all the parties who we've floated this to that this is a good reflection of the state of the law in this area. The two sponsors of the bill, Representative Kefouri, Senator Carter, are okay with this amendment. The realtors are not in opposition. All the members of that work group that negotiated this are behind this. The City of Portland has no objection, and so I would urge you to adopt this amendment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Niebel.
Thank you. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's see if there are any. Committee discussion?
Good idea.
Thank you. Really appreciate your work on this bill and getting to the sponsors. Commissioner Gardner, appreciate your amendment. We'll come back to this next week. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2379. And... 2535. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2186. Mr. Douglas. Yeah, we'll come back to it next week. If they want to do this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants. With me today are three CPAs, Kim Spalding, Robert Karras, and Bruce Crone. You have been provided a booklet which describes the changes the federal government has made and the potential impact of those changes on Oregon's tax code. Our three CPAs today are prepared to go through that booklet and describe those changes to you. I would only state that we've already seen that when you do not have rolling reconnect, there are various technical problems that you can run into, even when you try and draft a good disconnect bill. So it's very technical. It's very time-consuming. Should you move away from rolling reconnect, which it looks like 2186 has done already, we will be before you in successive sessions, spending a lot of time before both revenue committees describing those federal changes and how they affect Oregon's tax code. I do not anticipate that they will go through the entire booklet today. They're going to give you an overview and ask some questions about really how much detail you'd like to have. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Kim Spalding.
Thank you. And, Rob, I should thank our public accountants for coming today. I know that April 15th was not too long ago, probably about, you could probably give us the hourly countdown since it occurred, but it's really kind of you to give up your time, and the materials that you have presented assist us a great deal, so thank you.
Thank you, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. I'm Kim Spalding, representing the Oregon Society of CPAs Taxation Committee, and we can go through this booklet however you'd like. We would recommend looking at Section C. Do you have the booklets with you?
Yes.
Okay. So Section C is the last, behind the last tab, and that's the section that describes federal law changes that Oregon needs to make a change in order to conform to the federal changes. Section A talks about the federal changes that were made that automatically tie under Oregon's current rolling connection. And B is the one that you will most likely want to skip, which were federal changes that don't impact Oregon because they fall outside of the scope of the Oregon tax code, whether it's a credit that Oregon doesn't prescribe to or some other administrative provision. So if you don't have any opposition, I'll start with Section C.
Hearing no opposition, okay. So ordered.
I just want that extension I've been asking for.
Well, it's too late now.
Okay. Do it now.
And
you weren't an actuary. You're a CPA.
Act Section 411 falls under the automatic reconnect, so we'll go over that in Section A. Bob Karras, here next to me, is going to start with Act Section 531 and 532.
All right. Chairman Deckert and the members of the committee, my name is Bob Karras, and I'm a CPA from Clackamas, Oregon, and like Kim and Bruce, I'm here to represent the Oregon Society of CPAs. This particular provision of the federal tax law deals with the estate tax. Oregon's estate inheritance tax, is a function of an allowance that's granted on the federal estate tax. This is in the form of a credit. This credit is going to go away over the next few years, and by let's see, by what year? By 2005, there will no longer be a credit. And if Oregon simply rolls over and allows this to happen, Oregon's collections for inheritance tax will drop to zero. So we wanted to suggest this to the committee's attention so that you were aware that that this was going to be happening without any further action on the legislation's part.
And so we need language, and I don't think this committee has entertained it yet. We do need language in some form on the estate tax issue, regardless, is what I've been advised. Paul's not here, Elizabeth.
Senator Deckard, we have those bills in the House, and we have been having hearings on those. So.
Okay.
Excellent, excellent. And so that's the end of the piece that I need to testify on. Section 641 is next.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, I'm Bruce Crowley. I'm a CPA from Oregon City. I'm going to talk about Act Section 641. This is the one provision in the pension area that requires a change in the Oregon tax laws, and it appears in Section 16 and 17 of HB 2186. The reason for this is that 457 plans under federal law have changed to be employer plans rather than deferred compensation plans. Under deferred compensation plans, the distributions are treated as wages for Oregon. So this is merely a change in the character of 457 plan distributions, and it's for purposes of the withholding requirements.
Okay. Chair Deckard, members of the committee. Okay, moving on to page 31. The next act section extends the period for tax-related deadlines and is addressed in Senate Bill 221. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped Act Section 801. The estimated tax due dates, it's a strange thing. It's a 15-day deal in October of 2004. That's an extension of an estimated tax deadline, and we think that's also addressed in Senate Bill 221.
Okay.
But it is a change that's different. Act Section 901 is a sunset provision, which you may have heard about this, but the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Act, all of the changes revert back to as if they'd never been enacted on January 1st, 2011. The Victims of Terrorism Tax Relief Act of 2001, Act Section 101, exempts income taxes of victims of terrorist attacks, and Act Section 103 reduces the estate tax of victims of terrorist attacks, and the Oklahoma City Act in 1995. Oregon does not have a provision dealing with this at the time. The Act Section 101, I think, is addressed in 2186. Act Section 112 gives the authority to postpone certain deadlines from 120 days to 1 year. Oregon has its own deadlines. Again, I think this is addressed in Senate Bill 221. Act Section 113 is similar to Act Section 101 and extends income tax relief for disability income where terrorist activity is involved. And I believe that's addressed in House Bill 2186. Bruce is going to cover the net operating loss provision of the Job Creation and Worker Assistance Act, Section 102.
Thank you. The Job Creation Worker Assistance Act 2002, Act Section 102, deals with net operating losses. You'll find the amendment in House Bill 2186, Section 15. The reason for this amendment, and this only affects individuals because corporations, Oregon corporations, cannot carry back losses. They can only carry them forward. The Oregon statute refers to NOLs as it exists at the close of the tax year for which the return is filed. Therefore, for 2001, if you had an NOL for federal purposes, you could carry it back 5 years, whereas you could only carry it back 2 years for Oregon purposes because the legislation was enacted in 2002, and you couldn't reach back to 2001 and make that change. So this would change the law to make it in conformity with federal.
Can I back up one and just ask a question on Act Section 901? So in the proposed federal legislation, I know we never know what's going to get enacted, but in the President's current proposed legislation, do you know that, does that December 31st, 2010 date, my understanding, at least portions of it, that takes, it makes them permanent, the tax cuts that were enacted, it was my understanding.
It's the opposite. I think the federal acts that were enacted go away January 2011. Is that what you'd said?
But the question, I think, was, am I correct? The question is whether there's pending legislation or proposed legislation that the president has advanced which might alter that. And I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
Senator Chairman Deckard, I don't think that the preview that I've seen so far of the Bush plan doesn't deal with the estate tax, and it doesn't deal with this deadline out here.
It doesn't.
It does not.
Okay.
But he has a few years to work on it, so.
That's true.
Okay. The last two X sections on page 33 are technical corrections. One is to the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Act that was dealt with on page 30, and the other is the Community Renewal Tax Relief Act. They're just technical corrections. 412 clarifies that a child will remain a dependent until they would have reached age 18, if there's, or until they're determined to be dead. It's a Missing Children's Act. For Oregon, it's an Oregon credit. The dependency, when you're a dependent, it results in an Oregon credit. So it would require a change if Oregon wants to conform. Do you have any questions on these Act Section Cs that require changes? Okay. Going forward to page one, I'll start first real quickly with Act Section 411 on page 30 is an A, and it extends the exclusion for employer-provided educational assistance. So that's something you can exclude from your taxable income. Oregon automatically picks that up as its definition of taxable income. And Bob is going to continue on with the Fisk Repeal and Extraterritorial Income Act.
Yeah. Let's see. Back in 2000, the Congress passed a repeal of the Foreign Sales Corporation regime. The Foreign Sales Corporation was a form of export subsidy for manufacturers here in the U.S. who exported overseas. That subsidy has been replaced by a new provision, a new way of creating the subsidy. Oregon has never respected that particular manufacturing incentive, and so if you were an Oregon manufacturer, you would have a modification to Oregon taxable income. The legislature has already picked up on this issue, and there is I can't remember the citation, but there is a bill pending, I believe, that deals with this whole issue here, because if Oregon fails to conform, or if Oregon continues to conform with this provision, Oregon is going to begin automatically granting a tax incentive to manufacturers because this regime has changed so drastically. So.
Now, this is Oregon-based manufacturers?
This is manufacturers with any Oregon nexus. So if let's say General Motors has an Oregon has income apportioned to Oregon, they're going to receive this benefit under Oregon law if no further changes are made. But as I said, I think someone, some bright person probably in the back of the room, caught on to this already and has already suggested a change.
Okay.
The Community Renewal Tax Relief Act of 2000 is next on page 2, and the first Act Sections 101 and 102 HUD has designated areas to be targeted for special tax incentives, some exclusion and deductions. Act Section 116 creates a tax deduction and defers gain on the sale of assets in empowerment zones. Act Section 162 extends and expands the expensing of environmental remediation costs. 165 extends and modifies the deduction for corporate donations of computer technology for educational purposes. Act Section 202 on page 3 made changes to the medical savings accounts. Act Section 401 changed the tax treatment of securities futures contracts dealing with capital gain versus ordinary income tax rates. The Installment Tax Correction Act had just one change that repealed the limitation that had been placed on using the installment sale. So it was back to how it was before the original act in 1999. The Economic Growth and Tax Relief Act of 2001, Act Section 103, increases the starting point for the phase-out of itemized deductions. Act Section 202 expands the adoption credit and adoption assistance programs. This specifically increases the exclusion in adoption assistance benefits. Act Section 204 is regarding the dependent care credit. The tax benefits have been increased. Act Section 303 changes the earned income credit and the phase-out for joint filers. Act Section 401 expands and modifies education IRAs. 402 makes modifications to the qualified tuition programs. Act Section 412 expands the limit, the previous 60-month limit on the student loan interest deduction. Act Section 413 provides an exclusion of certain amounts received under scholarship programs. Act Section 431 provides for a deduction for higher education expenses above the line rather than just above the line. Yeah, exactly. And Bob is going to continue on page 6.
We're still in the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001. Sections 541 through 542 of that act deal with some changes relating to the basis of property. When a person inherits a property from a decedent, under current law, that the basis in that property in the recipient's hands is stepped up to fair market value as of the date of death. Because the whole estate tax is going away, in order to sort of salvage some of the revenue loss that the repeal of the estate tax would bring about, Congress decided that that step up would no longer happen, and in fact that in many cases the basis of that property would simply transfer over on a carryover basis. If Oregon does not have any legislative changes, that regime is going to take place under Oregon law as well.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the next couple pages deal with the pension area, which the present bill...
They don't do pensions anymore. Can somebody give you the word?
Does this mean that I can just say that HB 2186 takes care of it and we can move along? All right.
No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead. Do whatever you're going to do.
Well, I'll be brief then. Act Section 601 provides for increased... contribution limits for IRAs, and for those of us 50 or over, even more higher contribution limits, which is a good thing because it's encouraging people to save for the retirement. And obviously, if you're over 50, you're a lot closer than most people.
Have you seen with the extension and the upping of the limits, increased activity? Whether I know the Roth has been pretty popular, but have you seen an uptick in your clients taking advantage of? Limits being raised.
I've seen increased IRA contribution limits being taken when possible, and on W-2s I've seen increased elective deferrals. Mm-hmm. So there are people that are taking advantage of this.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay, Act Section 602 creates a new kind of IRA. It's called the deemed IRA. You can make your contribution to an employer's plan, and as long as it's a separate account, it will be considered an IRA. Act Section 611, the defined contribution and defined benefit plan limits have been increased so that employers can make larger contributions for their employees. And this applies also to the elective deferrals for 401Ks, 403Bs, 457 plans, SEPs, and SIMPLES. Act Section 613 modifies the rules on top-heavy plans. This is all in the area of whether a plan is qualified, and it makes it a lot easier for plans to keep their qualified plan status. Act Section 614, elective employee deferrals are no longer taken into account in computing the employer's contribution deduction. It means a larger contribution for the employee. Act Section 615, Code Section 457 deferrals are no longer coordinated with contributions to other plans. So if you have an employee that has a 457 plan and a 403B plan at the same time, he doesn't have to coordinate the two plants. And the result is that he won't have any excess deferrals and therefore taxable income. Act Section 616, they changed the limitation on deductible contributions to a profit-sharing or stock bonus plan, and this increases from 15 to 25% of compensation, and it also applies to money purchase pension plans. So as a result, what we're seeing is a lot of money purchase plans terminated. You don't need the dual plans anymore, and people are going with a profit-sharing plan because they can contribute the maximum, and it's also discretionary, whereas the money purchase plan must be funded. So we're seeing a switch to money or profit-sharing plans. Act Section 617, 401K and 403B plans can treat post-2005, so this is out there a ways. Elected deferrals is after-tax Roth IRA contributions. So like the deemed IRA that I talked about earlier, people can set up a Roth IRA with their employer plan as long as it's kept separate. It has to be in a separate account. Act Section 631 provides catch-up contributions for people 50 or over. The earlier Act Section dealt with IRAs. This deals with 401Ks, 403Bs, SEPs, Simples, and 457B plans. Act Section 632 provides a percentage limitation on additions to a defined contribution plan. Increased from 25% to 100%. Now, it's still limited to the $40,000. So this type of provision has drawn a lot of comment because theoretically you could have an employee earning $40,000 and he could put all of it into a defined contribution plan. And the only question is, what's he going to live on? But it was nice that they provided this. It was earmarked as being more helpful to lower-income people. Act Section 635 deals with qualified plan distributions upon divorce. It now extends them to 457 plans. It was previously available for all other types of pension plans. Act Section 641 allows rollover contributions between plans, and so you can have a qualified retirement plan and roll it over into a 403B, and this is meant to enhance portability of pensions. Act Section 642, rollovers for IRAs are now being allowed into retirement plans, and this is only for the taxable portions thereof. You can have non-taxable portions. Those cannot be transferred into retirement plans. However, you can roll over an after-tax contribution to an IRA into a qualified plan as long as a separate account is maintained. It's like the deemed IRA account. Act Section 644 provides a hardship exception to the 60-day rule. Previously, if you took a distribution and you didn't from an IRA plan and you didn't get it back into an IRA plan by the 60th day, it was considered a distribution and fully taxable. It didn't take into account the fact that you might have a disaster or casualty, so this provides an exception for that. Act Section 647 provides for direct trustee-to-trustee transfers from a 403B or 457 plan to a defined benefit governmental plan, and this aids employees who work for various state and local governments and move from one to another throughout their career. Act Section 649 allows you to exclude amounts deferred under a 457 plan when they are made available but not paid out. That's an important distinction because prior, if they were made available but not taken out, they were still included in income. Act Section 651 deals with the current liability full funding limit. It'll be increased 160%. For 2001, 165 for 2002, and 170 for 2003, and then repeal for 2004. It's an important distinction because it used to be that if it was different from the minimum funding standard, you had a difference which had to be amortized over 20 years. So the difference would be deducted equally over a 20-year period. Act Section 652 The defined benefit plan contribution deduction will be no less than the unfunded current liability. Act Section 654, the maximum benefit payable at retirement for multi-employer defined benefit plan participants is now the $140,000 fixed amount. It used to be the lesser of average compensation for the $140,000 amount. Act Section 656 closed the loophole on amounts on prohibited allocations of S-Corporation ESOP stock. Act Section 658 clarified the treatment of contributions to a multi-employer plan. What it did was it closed another loophole where corporations were doubling up on their deductions for contributions. The Secretary will promulgate regulations to clarify this area. Act Section 662, ESOP dividends, that's employee stock ownership plan dividends, may be reinvested without loss of a dividend deduction. It provides a deduction on the return of the corporation filing it. Act Section 665, employer-provided retirement advice is now an exclusion. That's an employee benefit. And Act Section 666 deals with Alaska Native Settlement Trusts that allows them to have a distribution to their settlement trust without having it treated as a taxable dividend. And that concludes the pension area.
Thank you. Senator Corcoran, did you have...
He's working on pension issues.
I'm working on a memorandum from our legislative council on the illegality of the pension plans that we're contemplating right now.
Yes, sir.
I have no questions. Got enough confusion for a lifetime.
Act Section 803 excludes restitution received by Holocaust victims. The Victims of Terrorism Tax Relief Act of 2001 deals just with what it's titled. Act Section 102 allows certain death benefits to be excluded from income. That's the September 11th or the Oklahoma City. Act Section 105 excludes cancellation of indebtedness from income. Exclusion for disaster relief payments is Act Section 111. And 116 is disability trust can now claim a personal exemption deduction, just like individuals can. Bruce is going to talk about the depreciation allowance, Act Section 101 of the Job Creation and Worker Assistance Act.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this act created a 30% bonus depreciation for certain qualifying assets. It had to be new property, could not be used property, and most tangible personal property and computer software were eligible for this credit. And I can attest to the fact that in my practice it's been very popular in conjunction with Section 179 deductions and providing benefits to our business clients.
So they're utilizing the bonus depreciation that was enacted in the federal law, or the federal stimulus.
Correct.
And we have an amendment in this bill. I don't know if we have it yet, Lisbeth, to keep connected to the bonus depreciation. So that's useful testimony for us to know that your clients are utilizing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an effective stimulus.
Oh, yes. It's a well-conceived targeted benefit, I might add, for businesses, and it's brought about essentially by the tragedy in New York. And it's available for property acquired between September 10th, 2001 and September 11th, 2004. So after that date, it'll disappear unless it's reenacted somehow.
Uh-huh.
And it is important to remember it is timing. Yeah. So if you lose the estate loses the revenue initially, but gets it back later.
Yeah, we're back into on this. We should get feedback from the initial loss. We should receive feedback in the coming years. It's good to hear the stimulative activity that this has. It requires an investment, and people are utilizing it.
Mr. Chair, but I do want to point out, I mean, the mere utilization of it doesn't indicate that it's a stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
Act Section 301 deals with New York City tax incentives. The 30% bonus depreciation there applies to a broader range of property, especially the non-residential and residential rental property that was destroyed as part of the attack on New York City. And certain leasehold improvements qualify for a five-year maker's life. Out here in the West, we have to stay with our 39-year life. And then the limit on writing off purchased depreciable assets is increased by the lesser of $35,000. This is on top of the current $24,000 for the cost of qualifying property, which is qualified New York Liberty Zone property. And I realize that this is a New York tax incentive, so you'd wonder what possible implication it would have here. Well, you might have people filing Oregon returns that live in New York, and so this affects their calculation of their federal income. Yeah. And thereby it affects, and actually it seems like to the extent this reduces their federal income and doesn't change their Oregon income, it would raise their apportionment percentage. But I'm sure it works both ways. So
I think that might have been an inside joke.
Account of humor.
We picked up on it.
Not an oxymoron.
Act Section 402 overrides a Supreme Court decision that had allowed cancellation of indebtedness to increase an S-corporation shareholder's basis. Act Section 403 specifies the types of businesses that can use the non-accrual experience method of accounting. Act Section 404 provides for an exclusion from income for foster care payments. Or it actually expands the exclusion for foster care payments. Act Section 405 expands the permissible range of interest rates for defined benefit plan computations. And Act Section 406 created an above-the-line deduction for classroom materials. Act Sections 411 through 418, that was only $250. I'm sure it helps teachers.
We have a tax credit bill that does, where we heard one, that does would create a state similar credit, and I think the decision of the committee was largely to see how this one works. So it'll be interesting to hear if we see how much activity we see on this 406 section federally will tell us how many teachers are utilizing it to receive a credit back.
So would the credit be tied with how much they were deducting on the federal return? Or is that in addition?
It's in addition.
Because most teachers that I've heard, they spend $250, or they spend at least something out of their own pockets, and it would be taking advantage of this. They wouldn't necessarily be spending more because this is in effect. That's good.
They'll receive more back. It'll be interesting to see. I don't know, with your clients that are teachers, are they utilizing it? Are they accessing the tax credit, or is it a deduction?
Yeah, it's a deduction. Yeah. So I don't know how Oregon, or I guess the credit would want to keep in mind this, and I don't know if it would be dollars above the $250 deduction, because as the law exists now, since you're connected to this, they get the deduction since you start with the federal taxable income.
Oh.
Then you would be allowing the credit in addition to this deduction.
Mm-hmm.
Act Sections 411 through 418 at the bottom of page 15 are technical corrections, again, to the same acts that we've already been talking about. And on page 16, these are extensions of provisions that were expiring. There was a phase down of the deduction for qualified clean fuel vehicle property, and a limit on percentage depletion, a reduction of deductions for mutual life insurance companies, medical savings accounts were extended, and accelerated depreciation rules for Indian reservations were extended. And subpart F, active financing income, which I know you're excited about. So that's it on recommendations A. Again, recommendations B do fall outside the scope of what impacts Oregon. So we're happy to walk you through these provisions if you'd like, but they don't apply.
They don't apply. So you can't.
Okay,
can
let's do them then.
Are.
We're a pretty pointless institution here. We're happy to accommodate.
When we go through our analysis, you know, what we're doing is weeding out what the federal law changes are. So we're throwing all of these in here, and that's why they're here. I assume you don't want to hear about them.
assume correctly that you've driven out everybody else on the committee. We're so far.
Mr. Chair, I notice a big departure during the pension section.
Well, this is the highlight. Liz Beth, who's our committee administrator, this is the highlight of her session when we do this book. So you have some like-minded souls. Mm-hmm. Any general counsel that you would provide this committee as we look at the connect bill or the disconnect bill and anything else that you would want us to know? It's interesting to hear what your clients are utilizing. It's a big, we debate that often, of what works, what doesn't work. It's also always interesting to hear what is actually working out in the field when we try to put incentives in place or debate these things.
Mr. Chair and member of the committee, members, we do want to express our appreciation for being very considerate of the difficulties that are created when you disconnect totally from the Internal Revenue Code, because the things that are timing, it can get so convoluted and you lose people. I mean, you know, you've heard of all the reasons. So, and we'd certainly be happy to help you in any way and any other things that come up. If you need explanations of how things impact Oregon, and how, you know, if you consider other methods and expand the amendments to this bill or think of other ways. So.
And do you feel that the Senator Corcoran?
No. Well, I just wanted to basically, I mean, Senator Deckard, thank you for having to put up with us during, you know, right after April 15th. But I want to really thank you, too, for, as an organization, for not opposing the disconnects that we can do in order to you know, get through the economic crisis we're in, and that's really important. And if you guys had opposed it as an organization, it would have been a very difficult deal for everybody in the building. So take that back to your membership, that we really appreciate that.
Thank you.
That is accurate. What was I going to ask?
You know what I'm going to do, Mr. Chair? I'm not letting these witnesses leave and say, punish my poor colleagues, they're gone. Mm-hmm. I want one CPA joke before they leave.
Okay. Well, we'll end it there.
Oh, he looks like a deer in the headlights.
So soon after April 15th, you want humor, right?
That's out of the question. I mean, there just aren't any.
How do you know an extroverted actual CPA, they're looking at when you're going to come.
Your shoes.
They're looking at.
Yeah. I did hear a couple of good actuarial jokes.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate, especially 8 days out, another successful season. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so Liz Beth, we did receive our amendment on the bonus depreciation issue.
Yeah, and Chairman Decker, just so everyone's clear, this is the amendment we should have had on the House side that does what we had hoped the bill would do. And so basically what you're having, like the CPAs just were saying, you've got we've had in Section A all of the rolling reconnect, and then what this bill is going to do now is establish December 31st, 2002 as the connection date to the Internal Revenue Code for Oregon tax matters, including that definition of taxable income. So everything in that Section A will all become law. It already is. But that then becomes the cutoff point, and December 31st, 2002 becomes our connection date for federal law. Now, the exceptions are then is we have reestablished the rolling reconnect for changes in federal law pertaining to those issues with depreciation, 179 expensing, pensions, employee stock ownership, deferred compensation, individual retirement plans, medical savings accounts, educational IRAs, qualified tuition savings accounts, or other tax-exempt savings programs. Because part of the Bush plan is to do, at least so far from what we've seen, is to have some real changes in these savings programs. So that is all to have rolling reconnect. We would be connecting with any of those changes that may come out of the Bush plan. And so then what we also have, again, in this rolling reconnect is you have this disconnect between any federal law changes that will occur in 2003 and 2004 and 2005. Then in 2006, you have the rolling reconnect going forward again. So in 2005, you can come in as a legislature and decide again whether or not you would like to continue that rolling reconnect for federal law changes after December 31st, 2005, or do you want to cut that off and change that next session? So it'll probably just depend on what you see in the future as far as changes in the federal stimulus packages and stuff.
So we're going to revisit this.
Yes.
Regardless of the amendments that were adopted in the House.
Correct.
Okay. Anyone else? 2186. Close the public hearing on 2186. Thank the CPAs. And we have one more bill, don't we? 2380.
Two more.
Here we have two. One of them. I hope Mr. Douglas will teach those guys some actual some jokes for the next time. It would really help the routine. Okay. There's got to be one funny CPA in the state. That guy Roy Rogers is pretty funny. Yeah. Yeah? I think you're probably right. My CPA doesn't have a sense of humor, except when she's collecting my check at the end of the day.
Okay, so I'll ask.
Yeah. I have news. That's a target.
But they can't. Right. A work session in Biden. They got their chance.
Right.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll bring them up. We'll open a work session. We'll bring them up. Okay. Work on that one. Let's do 2380. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2380.
Mazin. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2380 also comes to us from originated with the City of Portland, and then went through the House Revenue Committee and passed the floor of the House as well, and it gives the ability for property being subject to housing assistance contract to do these applications and issues prior to the process, which speeds it up. It also expands this exemption program to older rental buildings. This also is a program that is evaluated biennially by the Department of Revenue, the Tax Expenditure Report, and there's about two or three pages in your packet about this. However, the expansion, it seems like the revenue impact of the expansion did not make it to the packet. The expansion still connects with the date of the sunset, which is 2006, and in that we expect a half a year impact in fiscal year 04 of 261 for the total of the 03-05 biennium of about $1.25 million, and fiscal year 06 will have only a half a year because that when the sunset date comes in at $740,000 additional. This is no fiscal impact in addition to the revenue impact that we've just talked about.
Thank you. Ms. Kafori, Mr. Saba.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Malik. For the record, I'm Marge Kafori, representing the City of Portland, and with me again is Mike Saba, who will explain the bill to you. I would like to say that
This bill passed out of House Revenue with a vote of 9-0, and it passed the floor of the House, 57 aye votes and 3 excused, so there's absolutely no controversy with this bill. In contrast to 2379, which was focused on owner-occupied low-income purchased housing, House Bill 2380 is focused on the owners of low-income rental housing. What we're trying to do with this bill is to keep that housing affordable by providing or offering a limited tax abatement to the owners of that housing if they enter into a housing assistance contract. So with that introduction, I'd like to have Mr. Saba explain the rest of the bill and answer any questions you might have.
Again, thank you, Chair and committee members. This essentially is a concept that the City of Portland's interested in pursuing. It would amend a section of the statute, ORS 307-600, et cetera, to expand the current 10-year property tax exemption to induce the construction of new multiple-unit housing, to expand this to include the preservation of existing privately owned housing that may need repair. The owners might be induced into entering into a low-income housing assistance contract had we the tax exemption to add a little icing on the cake to encourage them to do that. We have no local program yet to do that, and it's really associated with the attempt at housing preservation the city adopted in terms of, in the form of a program to keep existing housing that's subject to a low-income rental assistance contract in those contracts. This would be able to induce privately owned housing to enter into that type of contract. So it's really, it's a concept. We don't have a local program that does this yet. It would not change any requirement that applies to the adoption of a new tax exemption program to go through the process, develop standards, go through a hearing, pass an ordinance, and get the endorsement of other taxing jurisdictions in Multnomah County to do this. It's a concept we'd like to try. It's sort of the carrot approach to try to get existing non-subsidized housing that might need repair and would benefit from some other subsidy to encourage the owners to engage in that type of subsidy. And that's essentially what it is.
And there are no amendments, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to the bill.
Thank you. Questions, comments?
Just one comment, Mr. Chairman. I was listening into the committee hearing from my office while trying to conduct other business, and I heard a representative Corcoran, or Senator Corcoran, indicate that there were no funny CPAs. I think that was his comment, and that's because his CPA resides on cell block D. So he has no sense of
humor. Cell block D.
Mr. Chairman, these bills are rifle shots. And I think that rather than a broad-based tax approach, they are very specific, very narrow. And I think they've, in the previous example that we heard earlier today, they have a track record. This is, I think, an extension of a successful program. So I think it's a good program.
Thank you. We'll try to bring this back next week in company with your other bill sometime next week.
Okay. Thank you,
great.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. You can check with the members of the committee in the interim intervening time. That would be great. Close the public hearing on 2380. You can't
quorum.
Can't do a work session without a quorum. Can you do? Can you allow people out?
You can hold a public hearing on anything you want, any time you want, Mr. Chairman. You simply can't open a work session on any bill without a quorum.
We mistakenly put 2535 up for a work session.
No. We haven't publicized the public hearing.
We only publicized the
public hearing. So you need a quorum.
Yes, we can have a public hearing for 24 hours.
So we're stymied.
So on 2535, we made a mistake and only listed it for a work session, so we're going to have to come back to this bill. Sorry if that inconvenienced a couple of folks. We will schedule this. Well, if we did inconvene someone, come and talk to Paul or Mazin, and we can schedule it at a time that might work. But we haven't had a public hearing, so it wouldn't do us any good to open a work session with only two of us.
Gosh, Mr. Chairman, if we had a quorum, I could move to suspend the rules so that we could have a hearing without a...
That's true, on this one, and get the testimony. So we'll come back to this Monday or Tuesday of next week.
You missed my comment.
With that,
747 back.
No.
But it's still the 23rd.
We are adjourned.